The next contestants on Let's Make Some Jobs:
President Obama and Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It is the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. Today is Thursday, September 8th.
Coming up, a couple of big economic speeches today. The president on jobs and the Fed chief on economic growth.
The GOP weighs in on the economy and healthcare.
What one study says is the reason we Americans pay so much at the doctor's office and hospital.
And later, billions of dollars worth of coins and not a cent to spend.
Ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
The number of people seeking first-time unemployment benefits from the government went in the wrong direction last week. It ticked up by 2,000 to 414,000. Now, economists look for a number below 375,000 to show that sustainable job growth is happening.
And job growth is the subject of President Obama's speech tonight before Congress, and it's where we'll start as we continue with the breakdown. Our economy one step at a time, that is Marketplace's special look at jobs and getting America back to work. Diane Swonk is chief economist with Mesirow Financial. She joins us now from Chicago, as she does every Thursday. Good morning.
Morning.
Well, Diane, first on the president's speech, let's talk about a dilemma that seems to be shaping up, which is that either the president might propose something that's so big it can't get through Congress, or he proposes something so small that it won't actually do much to create jobs.
That's exactly the problem. I think he will go somewhat big on his proposal, but we all know much of it's dead on arrival, as Republicans have already made clear. So not being able to think in this broader term of stimulus within the context of austerity has really hobbled fiscal policy for the moment.
All right. Well, what about the Fed? Chairman Ben Bernanke is speaking today, and some people are starting to talk about maybe he might actually announce some sort of new stimulus. What do you know about that?
Well, he's not going to announce anything new today, but I think he'll underscore what the Fed can do and then execute on that in September. One of the new things we're going to see that the Fed has talked about is something called Operation Twist, which, ironically enough, was done in the early 1960s and named after Chubby Checker's famous song, The Twist. So,
well, when I hear that the twist, I think, let's twist again like we did last summer. If this is a term that we're going to be hearing a lot of, the twist, tell us what it means. What is it?
Well, you know, it's not all that different from QE2, which we did have last summer, so there's some similarities, but it won't increase the Fed's balance sheet. What the Fed is going to do is sell short-term Treasury bonds and buy long-term to try to lower long-term bond yields. That's the goal. It was the goal of QE2, which we did see happen in the lead-up to QE2, and we're already seeing bond yields move down as traders and financial markets expect the Fed to do exactly that.
Why long-term? What does that do?
Well, what it does is it forces people out of the safety of not making bets on the future to placing bigger bets on the future of the U.S. in equity markets and other assets. The issue is to them to get out of safe, sort of current-day cash kind of investments into making long-term bets, riskier bets on the future, and that will help us to grow long-term.
One more quick thing, Diane. Here's Mitt Romney last night in the debate talking about Ben Bernanke.
I think Ben Bernanke has overinflated the amount of currency that he's created. QE2 did not work. It did not get Americans back to work. It did not get the economy going again. We're still seeing declining numbers in prior quarter estimates as to what the growth would be.
So does he have a point, Diane?
I think presidents and presidential candidates should stick to fiscal policy, not monetary policy. Ben Bernanke is one of the bravest men I know.
Diane Swonk, chief economist with Mesirow Financial. Thanks, as always.
Thank you.
President Obama came into office in the midst of the Great Recession. He's been in the White House now for more than 2.5 years. Could he have done more sooner to get the economy rolling? From Washington, here's Marketplace's John Dimsdale.
When he arrived at the White House, President Obama continued the bailout of big banks. He also propped up the auto industry and spent $800 billion to stimulate the economy. Jared Bernstein was a White House economic advisor at the time. He says all those measures worked well.
They just didn't last long enough. So if there was anything that was kind of missed, it was the length and depth of this kind of a recession.
What made this recession deeper and longer, economists say, is the bursting of the housing bubble. That left many consumers a lot poorer and unwilling to spend money. William Galston is a former policy advisor for President Clinton.
The home mortgage crisis isn't just a piece of the problem. It's the nub of the problem.
Galston says in exchange for the government bailout, Congress should have required banks to write down some of the principal and interest on troubled mortgages. He says the White House could have forced that through if the president's team hadn't been so focused on other issues.
If you spend a lot of time in the midst of an economic emergency on issues like health care reform and climate change, that's time that you don't have to spend on the economic crisis.
Galston says the president should have created an infrastructure bank in addition to housing reforms. Both, he says, would have paid longer-term dividends in reversing a deeper downturn than the president realized in the beginning. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The nation's trade deficit shrank in July by more than expected after the U.S. sold more goods to Latin America.
Ratings firm Fitch said today it may downgrade China's credit rating in the next couple of years if that country doesn't get its debt in order. You see, Chinese banks loaned out a lot of money a few years back to bolster its economy. And Apple wants Japan to ban the sales of some Samsung gadgets in that country, saying its electronics rival violates iPhone and iPad patents.
Well, we are on the iPhone and the iPad. We've got the Marketplace app for the iPhone, and we don't have an actual app for the iPad, but the iPhone app works on it. It's just like three times the size.
Bigger, yeah.
It's just bigger. That's the way half of those iPad apps are anyway these days. So there you go. We're also on Twitter at normal size. I am at Jeremy Hobson.
And I am at Radio Chio.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
The Congressional Super Committee that's going to try and tackle deficit reduction meets today for the first time. The Joint Select Committee on Deficit Reduction, as it's called, will look for ways to knock off $1.5 trillion from the deficit. Needless to say, lobbyists are circling like buzzards over a pumpkin patch. From Washington, here's Marketplace's David Gura.
On the Super Committee, there are 12 heavy hitters: the Senate Minority Whip, the head of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee.
And all of them have long-term relationships with donors and lobbyists in Washington.
That's Bill Allison. He's with the Sunlight Foundation, a lobbying watchdog. Dozens of lobbyists used to work for the Super Committee's members, and they're happy to visit their old bosses. Lobbyist Rich Gold is with Holland and Knight. He says every special interest has something at stake.
You're really talking about soup to nuts, the entirety of what people consider to be the government.
David Thomas is a lobbyist with Melman Vogel Castagnetti. He says nobody can sit this one out.
If you care about some of these issues, you definitely need to be up on the Hill working it.
The Super Committee can't reach a consensus, or if Congress doesn't pass what the Super Committee recommends, there will be across-the-board cuts to security and domestic spending. And Kevin O'Neill, a lobbyist at Patton Boggs, says some special interest may see that as the best possible outcome.
I think more interest groups will realize, hey, we'd be better off with this across-the-board approach than we are with the bill that's coming out of the Super Committee.
And that would create another opportunity for lobbyists who would shift their attention from the Super Committee back to the whole Congress. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Now let's talk to one of the members of that Super Committee. Javier Becerra is a Democrat from California, and he's with us now on the line. Good morning, sir.
Steve, good to be with you.
What's on the table as you head into these talks?
Well, everything should be on the table, and from there we decide what stays on the table.
Democrats have been resistant to reforming Medicare and Medicaid. Republicans have been resistant to tax increases. I mean, is everything really on the table?
Everything should be on the table. And before we start making cuts to important programs, we should make sure we're taking care of looking at those that don't work, not the ones that protect ordinary Americans like Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security. Every tax program that's out there, every particular program under the Department of Defense, no sacred cow should be left outside the door, and we should hang up our egos and those special interest pledges and say we're ready to work on behalf of the American public.
The committee is going to have until late November, November 23rd, to come up with a plan. If there's no plan, or Congress doesn't adopt a plan, that's going to force these automatic cuts across the board. Is that the kind of outcome that you'd like?
Well, no one wants to see the dull guillotine used to try to figure out how we find the savings that we need to reduce these deficits. And that's why I think all of us have this incentive to treat this like a failure is not an option proposal, because if we go in there believing that it's okay to just cut indiscriminately very important services, we're all going to face the guillotine come Election Day.
Some Democrats I know have called for this panel to add policies that would create jobs, not just reduce the debt. Do you believe that's a constructive goal? I mean, will you push for policies that amount to some sort of job stimulus?
Steve, it's not just a constructive goal. I think it's an indispensable component of a solution. There is no way you put America back on track if you've got 15 million Americans who are without a job through no fault of their own. Once you start to put those folks back to work, they start paying taxes instead of taking services. Treasury starts to collect some of the revenue that it's been losing. We start to decrease the deficit. So without a robust economy in the United States, it'll be nearly impossible to see the deficits shrink.
Congressman Javier Becerra, Democrat from California, thank you, sir.
Thanks, Steve.
All this week, we've been looking at how the 9/11 terror attacks have changed business and the economy. Today, we focus on cargo shippers. Their biggest security concern used to be theft. Not anymore, as Marketplace's Eve Troh reports.
Everything about the Port of Los Angeles is larger than life. But for each cargo ship that looms like a skyscraper, there's now a tiny vessel tethered alongside.
That's one of our port police boats.
Ron Boyd is police chief at the port. He says since 9/11, police, Coast Guard, and other agencies tag along with cargo on the water. When the huge metal containers get plucked off the ships, more checks, some for suspicious cargo, others random. They don't look at everything, but they're looking much more closely.
They're going to go through with the X-ray machine and look at those containers intrinsically. They'll be able to tell if there's a small handgun in there.
There being a densely packed 40-foot container. Security scans for invisible threats, too, like radiation. Port Executive Director John Holmes says there's been a big post-9/11 learning curve.
There are a lot of products that give off radiation that are not dangerous. Kitty litter, bananas, ceramics.
But the most precious cargo is actually people, the tens of thousands of passengers who board cruise ships at ports. Since 9/11, scuba divers check cruise ship hulls for bombs. Sea marshals ride along with some partying passengers. Police Chief Boyd says seaports are not like airports. Here, the public doesn't see the added security.
Folks who are here on vacation, they don't necessarily want to see a heavy sense of security. So it is a little bit of a difference.
All the new security has cost millions. The huge scanning machines, new boats, hundreds of hidden cameras. Not to mention more workers on the payroll, says Port Executive John Holmes.
The port has created hundreds and hundreds of jobs in this area of security.
Some ports charge new fees to pay for it, or they've upped the rent for clients.
The new normal, that's the cost of doing business.
It's a cost that's here to stay. I'm Eve Troh for Marketplace.
And you can find all of our stories about how 9/11 has changed business and the economy at marketplace.org. There is also an interactive look at the most costly disasters of all time. That's also at marketplace.org. And tomorrow, we will look at how 9/11 has affected Muslim charities in the United States.
Now to the Marketplace Global perspective, we're off to China, where it may surprise you that there's a jobless crisis there as well. Estimates are China's unemployment rate is around 20%. From Shanghai, Marketplace's Rob Schmitz reports, one problem is many college grads aren't qualified.
6 million Chinese students just graduated from college this past spring. Nearly a fifth of them haven't found jobs yet. And according to Sean Ryan, author of the forthcoming book, The End of Cheap China, the ones who have found jobs aren't happy.
Well, young university graduates are so optimistic about their careers, and I think they overvalue their own skill set, so they're never happy with their current jobs. They're demanding higher salaries and think they're worth a lot more.
They're a lot like 24-year-old Zhou Wei. He got a job at an international PR firm right out of college.
I was always at the office until 11 at night some days, and my salary was too low.
He quit, and now he works from home. Joe rifles through a stack of T-shirts at his Shanghai apartment. He sells these on the e-commerce site Taobao, China's version of eBay. Sean Ryan says many young Chinese, unimpressed with their options, are starting their own businesses, many of them on China's growing number of e-commerce sites. Joe Wei's only sold 7 T-shirts so far and is still living off the savings from his first job. He's technically unemployed, but he likes the independence. This trend is giving more young Chinese entrepreneurial experience, but at least in the short run, it's not solving the country's unemployment problem. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Steve, there were 2 notable items this week in the firing of Yahoo CEO Carol Bartz. Okay. First of all, she was fired over the phone, which,
yeah,
you know,
it's just
wrong.
You
don't break
wrong.
Up with someone over the phone. You don't fire someone over the phone.
Look him in the eye.
Look him in the eye. Secondly, when she then wrote an email to the entire staff of Yahoo saying, you know, it's been nice knowing you all, I'll see you later.
Yeah.
The last line of the email was sent from my iPad,
which
I just feel like, you know, when it's an important email, you might want to delete that part. Steve, did you watch the Republican debate last night on TV?
I saw bits and pieces of it.
Well, I knew that I was going to be doing an interview this morning about it, and so I was deciding which pieces of tape we should pull from it this morning to play for our guest. And it was interesting to watch a presidential debate or a primary debate that it was interesting to watch a presidential debate looking for substance on economics, because I will tell you, there's not a lot. It's a lot. You get a bunch of politicians on stage.
Yeah, it's all generalities. Absolutely.
So it was a very interesting experience. Yeah. But we're going to talk about that now. There were 8 candidates in Simi Valley, California, at the Reagan Library talking about what they would do to shore up the economy and create jobs and a lot more. And we're going to dig into some of the economic thought that came up in the Republican debate now with our economics correspondent, Chris Farrell. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, let's start with jobs and Rick Perry, the governor of Texas. In the debate last night, he was talking about welfare and jobs. Here he is.
John Kennedy said that the most powerful welfare reform program was a job, and that's what we need to get focused on in this country today.
Now, Governor Perry has come under fire for a lot of the jobs that were created in Texas during his tenure were low-wage jobs, but isn't a low-wage job better than no job at all?
Oh, absolutely. Look, there's not an economist that I can think of, and I live in this economic universe where they're liberal, mainstream, conservative, that wouldn't agree with what President Kennedy said and what Governor Perry said, which is that the best welfare program is a job. The question is, how do you get those jobs? And then later on, there's a question about the quality of those jobs. But yes, the best welfare program, a job.
So is there a problem with Governor Perry saying, I had this great job creation record in Texas, even if a lot of those were low-wage jobs?
Well, there you start getting into the questions about the price of those low-wage jobs. One, there's a high unemployment rate. There's a real concern about the steep high school dropout rate in Texas. And remember, we exist in a global economy. And what is our comparative advantage? What does our edge really exist in? That is education, knowledge, skill. So these are the questions that start being raised, not just partisan questions, but these are economic questions as we look forward to what kind of an economy will we be.
All right. Well, let's turn to Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Fed. And here is Governor Mitt Romney talking about him.
I think Ben Bernanke has overinflated the amount of currency that he's created. QE2 did not work. It did not get Americans back to work. It did not get the economy going again. We're still seeing declining numbers in prior quarter estimates as to what the growth would be.
So he says he wants to fire Ben Bernanke. What do you make of his criticism of the Fed?
I think a lot of economists would disagree with the criticism of the Fed. The Fed has taken extraordinary actions in order to shore up the economy. There's a big debate about whether the Fed is overreached, but there's not a whole lot of inflation out there right now. Inflation's pretty tame. And the other point is, by the way, you can't fire the chairman of the Fed. The Fed president can be really mad,
right?
Really mad. I mean, really mad. But that's like being mad at a Supreme Court justice. You can't fire them.
Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell. Chris, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
Well, Jeremy and Chris, also at the debate last night, GOP candidates were quick to criticize President Obama's health care overhaul, or Obamacare, as many have called it, dubbed it. Minnesota Representative Michelle Bachmann says she'd repeal the new law. Former Utah Governor John Huntsman said the healthcare industry can save a lot of money by cutting costs and computerizing medical records. But a study out today in the journal Health Affairs says a big reason Americans pay more for healthcare is because doctors get paid so much money. Marketplace's Amy Scott is with us now to talk about that. Good morning, Amy.
Morning, Steve.
How much more for healthcare are we paying?
Well, let's take the example of hip surgery, a pretty common procedure in this country. With private insurance, it's nearly $4,000 in fees per procedure here, and that's about twice as much as in other countries. Medicare gets a cheaper rate, but still is paying 70% more than public insurance in other countries. And that's why, you know, U.S. doctors have much higher incomes than their counterparts elsewhere. The average orthopedic surgeon here makes close to $500,000 before taxes.
So what does that mean, Amy, for overall healthcare spending?
The study says those higher fees are the main drivers of higher overall U.S. spending on healthcare, as opposed to things like practice costs or med school tuition. Here's what J.B. Silvers, a health finance professor at Case Western, had to say about the findings.
One lesson might be if we ever want to control costs on this side, we need to regulate more, and that's anathema to most physicians. They just wouldn't even consider that as a possibility.
As you mentioned, we just had a major health insurance overhaul, and it didn't do much to address doctors' fees.
Marketplace's Amy Scott reporting live. Amy, thanks.
You're welcome.
Well, now to Tropical Storm Lee, or the remnants of it, which are causing some big flooding problems in the East Coast today. But oil and gas production in the Gulf of Mexico is slowly coming back online following the tropical storm. As Sarah Gardner reports, though, more storms are looming and consumers may soon be feeling the effects at the gas pump.
Oil and gas operators are now reboarding rigs and getting back to business. But as of yesterday afternoon, almost 37% of the region's oil production was still turned off. Industry consultant Andy Lipow.
The effects of Tropical Storm Lee have made its way into the marketplace, and we're seeing rises in crude oil and gasoline prices.
Lipow predicts you'll soon feel that at the gas pump, but analyst Stephen Shork says that bad weather bounce could quickly be offset by a change of seasons.
The good news is that because of environmental regulations, we actually begin to switch over to a winter-grade gasoline, which is cheaper to manufacture. So indeed, consumers are looking at potentially lower prices in the weeks ahead.
Keyword, potentially. Hurricane season's not over yet. Long term, Shork says, get used to the prices. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
And finally, Jeremy, officials at the Federal Reserve Bank in Baltimore say they are running out of storage room for $1 coins.
Nobody wants those coins.
No, they don't. A 2005 law requires the Fed to order the coins, which a lot of people don't use anyway. Do you have any dollar coins in your pocket?
I don't. You only get them like at Metro vending machines on the Amtrak trains, they give them to you as change.
Right. That's right, because they're not going to – exactly. They don't want to keep that many dollar – I don't know what it is about the Amtrak bill.
I think it's cute and old-fashioned.
Is that what it is? maybe they should go to Canada and get the loonies and the toonies that they have up there. Anyway, earlier this summer, the Fed reported to Congress that it amassed more than $1.2 billion of those coins at branches all across the country, I think like 28 branches across the country, including the one in Baltimore. A note to the Fed, in this economy, I'm going to guess there are plenty of folks who would love to store some of those burdensome coins for you. Get them off your hands.
That's
I'd
right.
be happy to take them off your
yeah,
hands. I'll put them in my
no
garage.
Problem with
no
that.
Problem storing that stuff. In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chittick.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.